Good afternoon. Welcome to the Democracy Forum. This is the sixth program in our series this year to broadcast at this time on the third Friday of each month. We are featuring topics in Maine's participatory democracy, encouraging citizens to take an active role in government and politics. This program is a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. Our conversation today is about pillars of democracy, the nonpartisan civil service. We'll talk about the value of a nonpartisan professional civil service in sustaining a functioning democracy. We'll cover the struggle to depoliticize the civil service going back to the end of the 19th century and bring it up to date, even to now. We're seeing the ranks of civil servants slashed, with some positions converted into political appointments. Where is this heading? What are the risks? If the deep state consists of well-educated professionals, are they the natural enemy of autocrats? How is this playing out in this moment, and how is it playing out in Maine? This show was pre-recorded on June 15th. Send your comments to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. I'll be your host for the Democracy Forum. Let me introduce our guests. Ryan LaRochelle is the senior lecturer at the Cohen Institute for Leadership and Public Service at the University of Maine. He's a scholar of political development. Ryan, so glad to have you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Rob Schreiber is managing director of the Civil Service Strong and Good Government Initiatives at Democracy Forward. Rob held senior roles in the U.S. Office of Personnel Management during both the Obama and Biden administrations, including as acting director from 2024 to 2025. Welcome, Rob.
Thanks, Ann. Great to be here.
So let's get started. Rob, let's put it to you first, sort of set the stage for us. We've titled this show Pillars of Democracy, Nonpartisan Civil Service. In what ways is that true, that a professional nonpartisan civil service is important to uphold a functioning democracy?
The spoil system wasn't working. It was a corrupt system. It was an inefficient system, and it didn't work well for the American people. And so on a bipartisan basis, since 1883, the country has relied on a nonpartisan civil service to handle the day-to-day functions of government. And it's really important for people to understand that, the federal workforce mostly lives and works outside of Washington, D.C. Over 80%+ of federal workers live and work outside of Washington, D.C. Most of the functions that are performed are not political at all. The occupation that has more people in it in the federal government than any other occupation is nurse. And so these are people that are serving veterans in VA hospitals, that are working in the Defense Department and various other agencies. There are a whole bunch of people in the federal government that do IT work. There's been an emphasis on cybersecurity as of late. Protecting the nation from cyber attacks from abroad is not a partisan issue. And I could go on and on about the kinds of functions that federal workers perform that really aren't partisan at all. And so when you ask why is a nonpartisan civil service important to our democracy, well, it's because our democracy depends on the federal government operating day in and day out, operating these programs that the American people rely upon. And it depends on people being hired into jobs based on their ability to perform what's required for those jobs and not who they voted for. Building out this merit-based system over the last 140 years on a bipartisan basis has been really important for continuity, for the American people to have confidence that the folks that were working in government jobs were doing so to carry out the obligations that are in the law, to carry out the president's directions, but to do so in a legal way. All of that is really important to building trust in government. And frankly, that's something that has been waning. And what's happened under this administration is ruining that trust even more, which is a real threat to our democracy.
I watched a movie a couple months ago about the assassination of President Garfield and the transition to, I guess it was Chester Arthur was his vice president. And I see you nodding, Ryan. Can you just briefly sort of tell that story?
Yeah, so as Rob mentioned, the early era of government jobs was incredibly political. These were what was known as the spoils system. Folks were just giving out jobs based on party loyalty. And in the 1870s and 1880s, there was this push to professionalize the civil service. And one of the individuals, a disgruntled office seeker, Charles Guiteau, who was the eventual assassin of President Garfield, was one of the after effects of that was that it put even more pressure on Congress to reform this system, which led to, again, as Rob mentioned, the Pendleton Act of 1883, which led to again the use of examinations and merit for these sorts of jobs, not just being a political handout.
That must have continued, though. I mean, some of the history of the League of Women Voters, which was founded in 1920, as you may know, one of the issues that was important to them in the early part of their founding years was nonpartisan professional civil service. So this must have been worked into the 20th century, right?
Absolutely, yeah. This was a major push of the entire progressive movement of the late 1890s and then into the first several decades of the 20th century, which was this move to, again, professionalize government work because of the importance. This is also a time when the federal government especially, is doing more and more as the nation industrializes and as the nation expands. The number of government jobs also starts to expand, and there's a real need to make sure that those jobs are based on merit, based on professional qualifications. And I think when the Pendleton Act went into effect in 1883, it only covered about 10% of the federal government, but by the sort of outbreak of World War I, I think it was up to about 60% of federal jobs were now covered under those civil service rules. And that, again, that was a major push by the progressive movement and activists of that era to bring some level of expertise to the functions and actions of government.
Now, not everybody in government is civil service, Rob. Some are obviously political appointees, which is probably a pretty small percentage. Like U.S. postal workers aren't still civil service, or are they?
Generally speaking, when we talk about the civil service, we talk about career workers in the federal government. That number's around 2 million. They work in all of the agencies that people are familiar with that make up the federal government. There are political appointees who typically are not considered civil servants because they serve at the pleasure of the president, although many political appointees will say that they are public servants, notwithstanding that legal distinction. There's
About
only
what percentage of that, of the whole thing, are political appointees, would you say?
there are only the traditionally there've only been about 4,000 political
Oh, out of
appointees.
2 million. Okay.
4,000 out of 2 million. That's
Okay.
right. And then you ask about postal workers, and they are it depends on the context for when you consider them civil servants or not. The Postal Service is not a traditional federal agency anymore, so that's a reason why people might consider them to be different. But postal workers are still federal workers. They are selected, hired based on merit, evaluated based on merit. They have protections against arbitrary treatments like civil servants have. So in many ways, postal workers are like civil servants, but certainly the way the postal service has evolved over time has sort of changed the way people might think about postal workers.
Yep. And what about CIA agents, for example? Are they civil servants, or I've heard something about exceptional or extraordinary service. What is that?
So you can get into some of the details of the different systems that govern civil servants. So CIA might be called accepted service, and that would mean that they are not governed by the same set of rules as like your VA nurse
Yep.
or your food inspector for the USDA. They may have separate rules because of their intelligence functions, but generally speaking, CIA agents would also be considered civil servants.
Okay. And when was it that that government employees unionized, Ryan? And was controversial at the time, maybe still is.
Absolutely, still is. And again, this has been a fairly gradual process. There was no sort of one moment when every federal employee joined the Association of Federal Government Employees, which is the primary federal government union. And you point out the controversy surrounding that, because there is this sort of myth that when workers are unionized, they are too difficult to fire, that sort of quality of work declines because of that. But in reality, the evidence shows that these protections are actually designed to insulate civil servants and government employees from political interference. And so the unionization of federal employees has been, as I point out, this sort of gradual process, particularly beginning in the 1930s and then well into the 50s and 60s, with some significant efforts to break that. The famous example of President Reagan firing the air traffic controllers as sort of one of the most high profile examples of simply trying to break the backs of unions. But there was another episode in the 1970s where President Nixon tried to dismantle an agency within the executive branch, and one of the without Congress passing a law to do so. And one of the reasons that that agency was able to prevent that closeout was because the employees were unionized, and they were able to bring suit against the Nixon administration because they had those protections. Now, again, that agency eventually got dismantled when Congress passed a law to do so about 10 years later under President Reagan. But that's really, one of the main reasons that government jobs, have been unionized, is to protect them from that federal interference. One of the things Rob pointed out, too, is that civil service jobs create continuity in government, which is really, really important. These folks have a tremendous amount of institutional knowledge. They know the rules that they're supposed to follow. They know how these agencies operate. And if there was this constant churn of bringing in an entirely new set of government employees every administration, it would lead to immense chaos and inefficiencies. So, union protections and various forms of stability in the civil service is designed to improve the function of government.
And that must be true, Rob, over the decades and half a century or whatever. I mean, these jobs have become more expertise required, we're a more technological society. There's more technical expertise required for the delivery of these services. So the continuity must be even more important now than it was a half a century ago.
Yeah, for sure. And, a half a century ago, a lot of the jobs in government were clerk positions. And, you needed to be trained and understand the functions to perform those clerk responsibilities. But the level of complexity is far greater now. The level of threats to the country and to our democracy is far greater. We have a whole department that didn't exist then that's been stood up called the Department of Homeland Security in response to the terrorist attacks of 9/11. And there's a whole bunch of different components of DHS that work together on that. The level of complexity in benefits determinations has increased over time. And I think the other thing is that no new administration comes in and works in a vacuum. There is, as Ryan was pointing out, incredible institutional knowledge that career civil servants possess about ways that prior administrations have attacked these ever more complex problems. And I would think that if you're coming into power, you want to hear from those folks. You want to take advantage of the knowledge that they have about what's been tried, what's worked, what hasn't worked. And that would be really important to you as you think about how you and your team are going to attack the problems of the next administration, that the next administration is facing, because as you mentioned, those problems are ever more complex.
Yeah. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today is Pillars of Democracy, the Nonpartisan Civil Service. Our guests this afternoon are Rob Shriver, Managing Director of the Civil Service Strong and Good Government Initiatives at Democracy Forward, and Ryan LaRochelle, Senior Lecturer at the Cohen Institute for Leadership and Public Service at the University of Maine. This program was pre-recorded on June 15th. No listener calls are being taken this afternoon. So what do you think, Rob, was the angle that, like, say, Doge came in with? And I know this whole Project 2025 had an agenda to reduce government and cut civil service. I mean, what's the argument for that? Were the protections too strict? Was it hard to get rid of people who weren't performing?
Let's be clear that DOGE is called the Department of Government Efficiency, but nothing that they did was really about efficiency. They came in with a mandate to reduce headcount. This was well articulated in Project 2025, as you mentioned. My organization, Democracy Forward, had studied Project 2025 and was prepared for what to expect. And what we saw play out was the most aggressive and cruel version of Project 2025 when it came to the federal workforce. We're seeing huge problems now in the government as a result of what DOGE carried out. The administration has scrambled to rehire people that they had laid off. It has launched a new tech program called Tech Force to bring people with technical talent back into government, because large numbers of folks that they let go were people who had those technical skills. They've only hired 10 people under that program so far, notwithstanding a goal of having hired 1,000 by March. So they're having a real problem getting kind of people back into government that they need. And there is a mass exodus of young people happening. The federal government has been challenged in the past to hire people under age 30. There was some progress being made towards the end of the Biden-Harris administration. That's been wiped out and then some. There's around 50,000 people under age 30 who have left federal government since the start of the Trump-Vance administration. So I think that their goal was not efficiency at all, but it was to, as the OMB director Russ Vogt said, to traumatize federal workers, to make them want to leave. They created out of whole cloth a voluntary resignation program where they literally paid federal workers for up to 8 months not to do the job, just as a way to get them to voluntarily relinquish their positions. And so now we've seen so far around 420,000 people who have left the federal workforce. That's 5 million years of experience. And I don't think DOGE had a care in the world about losing those people or about what it would mean to agency operations or the American public when that happened. I think it was all about scaring federal workers so that they wouldn't dare speak truth to power in the administration. And let me be clear that federal workers' job is to carry out the directions of the president and the agency leaders. They're the ones that were elected on an agenda, but they're to do so within the confines of the law. And so what these guys did was scare federal workers from raising concerns about whether the administration's activities were consistent with law. And I think that that, in addition to a raw headcount cut, was the design of DOGE.
Hmm. Do you want to comment on that, Ryan?
Yeah, I think, you know, there was this belief, I mean, you know, the efforts to, you know, scale back government, you know, go back decades. But there was this belief, especially in the first Trump administration, that President Trump could have accomplished more if it weren't for the deep state, these actors within government who were stymieing his actions. When in reality, as Rob points out, many of those actions were stymied because they were perhaps unconstitutional or out of line with current statutory law. And so when the Trump 2.0 begins, there is, you know, this effort to exert even more control over the federal bureaucracy via executive control. There's this legal framework called unitary executive theory, which suggests that the president has unilateral control over the entire federal bureaucracy under Article 2 of the Constitution. And therefore, DOGE was a manifestation of that, that if the president wants something done and there's some civil servant who isn't carrying that out, they should be able to be, you know, let go. But again, civil servants and the president are supposed to conform to the Constitution and the law. And that's, I think, you know, one of the reasons that, you know, DOGE and Project 2025, you know, those were some of the first things that the Trump administration began doing when they retook office in his second term, because there was, again, this belief that we need to act really fast. Otherwise, you know, the deep state will reign its head again, which, you know, as we've already talked about, the deep state is not, you know, this cadre of, you know, political agents that's nurses and IT professionals. 2.3 million people sounds like a lot, but when you think about the scope of the federal government, it's necessary to have that many employees spread out all across the country.
Do we know how many of those jobs were in Maine?
I don't know off the top of my head. Okay. Do you know, Rob?
I don't know. I don't know if the OPM data is broken down that way.
Yeah. Well, one thing that we wanted to ask about was the extent to which government jobs were an opportunity for socioeconomic advancement for, let's say, BIPOC people or for, you know, people who didn't come from a wealthy background. And if that's true, what kind of effect has the recent reduction had on those populations? What do you think, Rob?
I think that has been one of the real benefits of a merit-based professional civil service, is that these are good jobs that provide a ladder to the middle class for people across the country from all kinds of backgrounds. They're, you know, nobody gets rich working for the federal government. You don't hear people like, okay, I'm going to cash in by going to work for the government. It's a good living with good benefits, and people get to go there and work on things that they believe in. Folks who come to work for the federal government, the surveys show, are overwhelmingly driven by the mission. They want to help their local communities, and that's what attracts them to the job. When the tech layoffs were happening in the wake of right post COVID and everything, there was a surge of tech talent who wanted to come into government. They knew they weren't going to make nearly the same amount of money they were making in the private sector, but they did seek some stability there and the chance to work on things that they believe in. And so I think, like, if you look at the data, including the Trump administration's own analysis, federal workers are underpaid comparison to the private sector by some 24% or around that range. But, you know, at the entry level and in the blue collar positions, you know, the salary is competitive enough to be a ladder to the middle class. And there's been some analysis done that the cuts that have happened have fallen disproportionately on African-American women, who make up a substantial chunk of the federal workforce. I mentioned the exodus of talent in the early career that's been harmed by these cuts, and the overall destabilizing of federal employment has created new challenges for bringing all kinds of people into government, as we see by the fact that they've hired a whole 10 people under their tech force. So folks are looking at government employment now with more skepticism than they have in the past. And even in the past, federal workers understood that priorities might change and a new administration might come in and might shrink the government. And in fact, that happened during the Clinton administration under reinventing government. But they also knew that there was a legal structure for doing that, that would allow them to feel like they were treated fairly in that process. And that just wasn't followed now. And so for all kinds of communities, there's been some broken trust that will need to be rebuilt.
Since you raised the Clinton workforce reduction, let's talk about that for a second. Ryan, what are the differences between what's going on now and what happened during the Clinton administration?
Well, I think, you know, Rob gets to this, got to this already, which is, I mean, there are ways and mechanisms to restructure the federal civil service. There were efforts in the 1970s, which led, you know, which were led by bipartisan coalitions to, you know, reform parts of the civil service. As Rob points out, during the 1990s under President Clinton, the Reinventing Government initiative was a collaborative effort between the president and Congress, and an effort to rethink what the civil service should look like into the 21st century. That's very different from, you know, President Trump's actions of creating a Department of Government Efficiency, and I put that in quotation marks, because there was no law passed by Congress that established this new department. It was the creation, it was established by President Trump unilaterally and had, at best, tenuous legal authority to engage in some of the actions, which is why many folks who ended up getting fired by that sued. And as Rob points out, many of them actually had to get rehired because they realized that the government couldn't function anymore. But I think, you know, the efforts in the 1990s and also, you know, some efforts by President Reagan in the 1980s as well to think about how the government can better collaborate with private entities is a necessity in the 21st century. That's how government runs. It's not this unilateral top-down authority. It's government acts through private actors a lot of times, through nonprofits and things like that. And there are mechanisms to make that process more effective, which, again, I think we could debate the merits of both President Reagan's Grace Commission and the Reinventing Government initiative under President Clinton. But these were, again, more sort of thoughtful and measured approaches to rethinking the civil service than, you know, President Trump coming in and after the 2024 election and, you know, simply firing en masse, you know, thousands of federal workers. Because I think one of the things you do want to point out is I don't want to give the impression that the federal civil service is perfect. Of course, there are issues and challenges involved in managing, you know, 2.3 million people. It is really difficult for, you know, the president to administer their programs through this deep, you know, complex bureaucracy. But the solution, I don't think, is to simply fire these workers, but to engage in a much more wholesale, thoughtful reimagining of how the civil service could better serve the needs of the American people in the 21st century, which, again, you know, some of these earlier strategies were at least thinking along those terms. Whether they were effective is, I think, a different question.
Yeah. You want to comment on that, Rob?
Yeah, I think Ryan's right on. Nobody is arguing that the civil service was perfect and beyond reproach to the extent that we shouldn't think about reforming it. In fact, I think there have been many efforts to reform the civil service since the last major reform happened with the 1978 Civil Service Reform Act. And some haven't gotten kind of going, others were underway and ran into legal problems. Others were implemented under one president and didn't follow through under another president. So there really is a need to reimagine a government that is better situated to meet the challenges of the 21st century. Some of the laws on the books, like the pay and classification rules that govern the civil service, go back to like the 1940s. And so, yes, it's overdue for updating. And I think the people who are frustrated the most by bureaucracy, other than like customers and American people that are having to deal with it, but the federal workers themselves that find themselves in a job where, look, I wanted to come in here and make a difference and try to help things in my local community, but there's all of these rules and restraints that kind of limit me and my ability to do that. That's what I hear from civil servants is when we talk to them about reform, like, sign me up, like, and I will tell you what I thought worked well and what didn't work well, which, by the way, might have been a good place for DOGE to start, right? Like, mm-hmm. Maybe talk to the people doing these jobs and I think they would have some really good ideas about how to reform the system. So we do need to look at things like the way that we hire federal workers. We do need to look at the performance management system. Look, I think probably any company, nonprofits, state government, any would say that they should take a look at their performance management system because performance management is hard. It's cultural. It takes time. But we should look at that and we should make sure that you know, if somebody is abusing the trust that the taxpayers put in them, that they're held accountable for that, and that happens swiftly without too much burden.
You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Ryan LaRochelle, Senior Lecturer at the Cohen Institute for Leadership and Public Service at the University of Maine, and Rob Shriver, Managing Director of the Civil Service Strong and Good Government Initiatives at Democracy Forward. Our topic today is Pillars of Democracy, the Nonpartisan Civil Service. This show was pre-recorded. Send your comments or questions to news@weru.org. Put Democracy Forum in the subject line. So how is what's happening undermining a functioning democracy, Rob? Like, why is this bad for democracy, what's going on right now?
I think, and what's important to do is to connect up what's happening to the federal workforce to things that are happening around the country that are just bad for everybody involved. So we know, for example, that the shutting down of USAID has cost tens of thousands of lives around the world. Like, there's research to make that linkage. We can draw conclusions about the screwworm issues that are happening in Texas right now. We can draw that
back. Okay, wait a minute. People may not know about those screwworms. Just back up a little bit and say what's happening there.
So there's a problem with the cattle in Texas right now, where there's this screwworm infestation that is harming the cattle and potentially can make people sick. There were people in the federal government whose job it was to work on prevention of just that thing, screwworm, and to work on managing the crisis. There were people in the federal government whose job it was to help other countries manage outbreaks like Ebola and make sure that those outbreaks are contained as quickly as possible and that they don't spread and that they don't threaten other places around the world, including the United States. And we're seeing that there was a slow reaction to Ebola during this crisis. There are concerns about readiness for severe weather and whether the American people are not receiving information quickly enough and comprehensively enough about weather-related concerns. And then you can go like further and further, and time will tell on these things. Like, there's a reason why we hire meat inspectors based on their abilities to inspect meat and not based on their loyalty to the president. And so does anybody in the country want to have meat inspectors that were hired based on their loyalty? You can imagine what the downstream effects of that are. And so that's what keeps me up at night. We are putting together a comprehensive report at Democracy Forward that links the changes to the federal workforce to these risks and harms that are happening across the country. That will be out later this summer. And they're severe. And it's really just the beginning of it.
So you think we haven't seen more than the tip of the iceberg yet?
Yeah, I think we haven't seen nearly the fallout that's to come, because a lot of times the stuff that federal workers do is they work day to day to keep things going, to keep things safe, to keep things operating. And when you take them away, those gears grind down and they slow down, and then you start to see more and more impacts as time passes. And this administration, neither Doge nor Russ Vought or anybody else, actually had a plan for dealing with, okay, what happens when we get rid of all of these federal workers? What happens to the work they were doing?
You want to comment on that too, Ryan? How does this kind of workforce reduction, especially the way it's happening now, undermine people's faith in democracy?
Yeah, I think there's this really big question of the erosion of trust in government that occurs here as well. One of my former colleagues at the University of Maine, Amy Freed, and her co-author Doug Harris wrote a book a few years ago about the efforts by government actors to actually instill distrust in government. And one of the reasons for, you might wonder, like, why do government actors want to build up distrust in government? And it's so they can argue that government doesn't do its job well. And so one of the efforts, one of the strategies is when you shrink the federal workforce, when you make these programs work less effectively than they would with a functioning civil service, it builds up this perception amongst the American public that, well, government can't solve any of these problems anyway, and therefore they look instead to the private sector to solve some of these problems. Amy Lerman, a political scientist, wrote a book called Good Enough for Government Work, which looks at this, you know, sort of self-fulfilling prophecy of when you make it harder for government to do things, it builds up this belief amongst the American people, which is really hard to dislodge, that government can't do things. And again, I don't want to suggest that government is the only way to solve problems, but so many of our challenges in the 21st century are going to require government action, given the complexity of them, whether it's regulation of artificial intelligence, whether it's managing new disease outbreaks. These things cannot be strictly done by the private sector. And if you make government work less effectively, you increase distrust in government, which has already been increasing over the past several decades. And you also leave the system more prone to outsiders or leaders who are more bent on destruction moving forward. I mean, you see this in comparative perspective in a lot of countries around the world. One of the things that makes autocratic leaders so tempting for citizens in their countries is when things aren't working well. And so there is this really dangerous, cyclical nature to this, where, again, government becomes less able to solve problems, reduces public trust and faith in government, which then opens the door for anti-system leaders to continue chipping away at the system. And, you know, one other thing, Rob pointed this out earlier, the folks who become government employees don't do so for the paycheck. They do so because they believe in the cause. At the University of Maine, I talk to many students who are graduating from our political science program or from the School of Policy and International Affairs who want to go out and do good work. And the past several years, many of them have expressed great reticence to work in government because of this unease. You know, if I get a job now, is it going to still be there a year from now? Am I going to get fired when the next administration comes in? How do I know if this is going to be a stable job? And so you're losing a lot of talent and a lot of desire to, you know, serve the common good, which is ultimately what many of these civil servants are doing. And it becomes, again, kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy there.
In preparing for this show, we talked to somebody who was member of a multi-generational family of public servants. And the way they talk about it is it was a patriotic duty almost, all about the service. And they had made financial sacrifices to be able to do that when they could have been paid so much more in the private sector. But, you know, there was a commitment. So when this goes on, Rob, who benefits? Like, what's the big picture to making government not work?
I think Ryan is on to something, that there is a self-fulfilling prophecy for people who want the government to be perceived as ineffective. And so they create the conditions for that to play out. And if the government is then perceived as ineffective, the government's the one that is enforcing the rules. And if they're enforcing rules that protect folks, everyday folks, against the powerful interests in the country. And so if you delegitimize the government and make it ineffective, both to the point where it can't do as good a job protecting folks from powerful interests in the country, or there's a perception that it can't, well, that's pretty helpful to those who are part of the powerful interests in the country. So I think that's where a lot of this comes from, is who is the government trying to protect, and who is, like, on the other side of that, who's being regulated by the government and held accountable for breaking the law by the government. I think that most Americans think that, you know, it's important for civil servants to carry out their responsibilities consistent with the law and to identify the folks who are you know, taking advantage of everyday Americans. There's all kinds of tools set up to do that. One of my favorite examples to point to is there's a consumer complaint database that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has stood up and run. And like, this is a place where people can call in if they're, you know, being charged outrageous fees by their credit card companies or things like that. The kinds of things that are hurting everyday Americans and they by themselves don't have a whole lot of power to address. And so that complaint database is not even being monitored anymore. Like people are calling in with this, you know, they're being raked over the coals by their credit card companies, and there's nobody there to respond to that or to seek, you know, redress for those folks. You know, there was a whole direct file program that the IRS created so that everyday Americans could just file their taxes without having to pay for a service or pay for an accountant or anything like that. Widely applauded and really well done in the implementation. And that program has been killed. Why would an administration kill a direct file program that lets Americans file their taxes without having to go through a company? Unless maybe the companies didn't like that and wanted people to have to go through them. So you can look at all the different programs and who they're meant to help and who they're meant to help people deal with. And I think you can get your answer about who benefits from, you know, the destruction of the capacity of the civil service.
So, I mean, you're making it sound like it's the people who make money off the government. Is that saying it too strong?
Look, I think there are a lot of different business interests that that do better or worse off depending on how the government conducts their regulation of them and the oversight. And I think they spend a lot of money to try to influence things so that they go their way.
You want to comment on that?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of this, I mean, there are, you know, folks who have an ideological commitment to, you know, private action rather than government action. And I think, you know, if you look at the efforts to shrink government over, you know, say from the 1980s to today, I think many of the folks who have sought to shrink government have been behind many of these efforts to, you know, make it easier to fire civil servants, have also been at the forefront of these efforts to delegitimize parts of, you know, what, you know, the deep state or the American state. You know, again, I think this is one of the consequences of this is as people opt out of public institutions, whether that's public schools, public health insurance, you know, public housing, whatever it might be, they enter into private agreements, private arrangements. And this is a long-term political project. In the 1980s, you know, Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform, you know, said, I don't want to, you know, just kill government. I want to shrink it so that it's small enough to drown in the bathtub. And part of this creating this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy of making government work less efficiently is so that it is easier to therefore continue shrinking it into the future and give more authority to private interests, private companies who, you know, many believe can do this work more efficiently and effectively, but those private entities are, you know, not always bound by constitutional law or statutory law or administrative regulations that are so central to protecting public safety.
Or if I may say, even by the public interest.
Of course. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Ryan LaRochelle, senior lecturer at the Cohen Institute for Leadership and Public Service at the University of Maine, and Rob Shriver, managing director of the Civil Service Strong and Good Government Initiatives at Democracy Forward. Our topic this afternoon is Pillars of Democracy, the Nonpartisan Civil Service. The program was recorded on June 15th, so no listener calls are being taken now. So how do we turn the corner on this? Rob, you said that there are opportunities for reform, for streamlining, for performance management, for goals-based rethinking and make civil service better. But how do we put this back on track?
Yeah, I think that is the opportunity that we have now to sort of make lemonade out of a really sour tasting lemon. Civil service reform has been hard to come by for many, many reasons over the last 50 years. One of the reasons is that those who support a nonpartisan civil service protections for federal workers, had been concerned that if a broader debate were opened, that people that were more on the side of making government look bad, that they would change the law in negative ways. Well, all of that reason has kind of fallen by the wayside, right? Because all of those things have happened without changing the law. So what this really does is it gives us a moment to kind of take a step back and say, what is it that the American people really need from their government? And so at Democracy Forward, one of the things we're doing is engaging American people directly to ask them that question and see what their priorities are. I think we can go back to federal workers, as I mentioned, and say, all right, what were the obstacles to you being more effective in your job? We can go to organizations that have served people who have been let down by the government over the years, talk to them and the people that they represent and say, what is it that we can improve so the government works better for you? Because the fact of the matter is, the status quo wasn't fantastic either. There were a lot of people that were let down by government before Trump ever came along. And so we don't want to rebuild to the status quo. We want to reimagine a different type of government that better serves everybody in the country. And so we're doing that, as I said, by talking to the American people, by talking to former feds. We have a large coalition of over 400 organizations that now really understand that the government is important to the things that they care most about, and they want to be part of the discussion. We have to look at it from a policy and operational perspective. It's not enough to write a bunch of white papers about the change to the hiring process. We actually have to get into, how do you really hire people based on skills? Some of the workarounds that federal agencies have used in the past have not been effective. So what are really the operational tools that we need to implement to make a hiring reform a real thing? How do we look at the teams that have been designed in federal government? The HR team is one that's near and dear to my heart, human resources. They weren't necessarily working great across the board in government before. So let's modernize what an HR team looks like, identify the skills that people need to have to be successful, and then find those folks who are ready to come in and lead a reimagined HR operation. And let's do that across the board in different occupations across agencies, so that we can kind of re-engage the public, re-engage in the discussion about what is needed from our government to help rebuild that trust and design something that's going to operate better, more effectively, more efficiently, more transparently than was even before the Trump administration.
What about that, Ryan? What's it going to take?
Well, I agree with Rob in the sense that I think, especially in the aftermath of the DOGE cuts, you know, there is this real revelation amongst at least a portion of the American public that what these civil servants were doing is actually really important. Oh, and these aren't just faceless bureaucrats. These are my neighbors. These are the folks who aren't in faraway Washington, who are, you know, engaging in government action without any knowledge. So I do think in some ways the efforts to reduce the size and scope of government in the second Trump administration have reveal just how important government can be. And I do think, again, that leads to an opportunity for reform, as Rob pointed out, because so many of the problems that we're facing today, it will require some engagement from the federal government. And as Rob points out, there are a lot of opportunities and areas where things could be streamlined, managed more effectively. You know, this can happen with civil service reform, but also in the broader sense of regulatory reform and things like that to make government actually work, which is the real problem. I mean, this is, you know, the conservatives say government is too big, it's not working. And liberals say, well, government is too, you know, sort of rigid and old, it's not working. And they're both partly right on this. Government isn't operating as effectively as it should. And I think this, you know, recent, you know, attack on the federal workforce has revealed that, again, you know, government does need to play a role in public health protections and safety and things like that, but it needs to do so better. And so I think it opens up a real important dialogue for political leaders to have, you know, if there are folks in Congress who want to take up the mantle, you know, a subsequent administration who, you know, actually addresses these problems in a wholesale, thoughtful manner. Again, as Rob points out, DOGE could have done, you know, important work if they had approached it with thoughtful imagination of how to actually make, you know, especially on some of the, you know, introduction of new technologies and things like that, could have really streamlined a lot of federal government operations and procurement strategies. But that was not the approach they took. But that doesn't mean it wouldn't work in the future. And I think, again, this has revealed that there are opportunities for reform. It just needs to be done carefully and thoughtfully within the confines of the law.
Well, and of course, the cuts that have been done have not been sort of across the board. Some of the departments have been hit harder than others, like EPA, maybe in the Department of Justice, not so much Department of Homeland Security, which arguably has more people than before. So, I mean, some of this, like, where have all those people gone? I mean, that's another question. Like, where are all those DOJ lawyers now? That's not a rhetorical question. I'm really wondering.
Look, so the job market has been tough. I think I talk to federal workers, former federal workers every day who are struggling to find what's next for them. I think you have a lot of federal workers who are finding something in order to pay the bills, but they're really missing their teams and the impact that they were able to have as federal workers. Democracy Forward has hired several former DOJ lawyers because they wanted to be in the fight. They're horrified by what's happened at DOJ, and we're very active in litigating against the administration on a host of issues. I think we've brought over 400 lawsuits. You know, there's a lot of really great talent that left the federal government. Some of them are finding their way into state government, which is sort of more in line with where many of them want to be. Some have gone back home where they grew up and are taking on a totally different career path. There's good organizations out there that are helping feds find their next path. My program, Civil Service Strong, connects feds up with resources to help them, you know, find their next job. And there's other organizations out there that are doing the same. But it's been a tough road to hoe for many federal workers who literally were traumatized, just like Russ Vogt promised. They were traumatized. And then they were forced to find out what they have to do next. Some are able to find their path, and some are still struggling to do so.
We've watched as California, for example, tried to pick up some of the function that the CDC used to fulfill. And, you know, because we do work in elections, we've seen states collaborating to fill in the gaps from what CISA, the cybersecurity agency, did in elections. How much of the function is actually being picked up by states as opposed to just not getting done at all?
Some of it is being picked up by some states. The difference is that when the federal government does it, it's for all of us.
Everybody.
So I think there are real gaps in capacity that states are doing the best they can to fill. But what is any one particular state to do with respect to national security, for example? Like, how is a state supposed to pick up the slack for the fact that the administration hired our experts on Iran right on the eve of going to war with Iran? There are some things that uniquely are the federal government's ability to do. There's this great federal worker story that Michael Lewis told in one of his books about a guy who grew up in West Virginia. He was a software engineer. And when he was growing up, the roofs of coal mines were falling in and killing scores of coal miners every year. That guy worked for 40 years on that problem. And when he retired, the year he retired, not a single coal miner was lost to a roof of a coal mine collapsing. That's the kind of scope and scale that only the federal government can do. And when you take away the investment in the people and the resources the federal government has, you're losing out on projects like that.
Well, we're coming to the end of our time this afternoon, and I do want to give you each a couple of minutes to wrap up your parting thoughts and linking the federal civil service to trust in democracy, to a functioning democracy. So, Rob, do you want to go first?
Sure, Anne. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be on with Ryan. Really appreciate it. I think what I want to leave the audience with is what's happening to the federal workforce is not about the federal workers. When I talk to federal workers, the first thing they say to me is, what's going to happen to the work that I was doing? What's going to happen to the people who are depending on me? These are folks who are going through the worst thing that's ever happened to them in their career, and that's where their focus is. I think it's really important that we get the message out about how the federal workforce supports local communities around the country and around the world, but how the services that they provide are essential to Americans living healthy, living safe, at their economic prosperity, everything else that's important in your day-to-day lives. Federal workers are behind the scenes. They are carrying out their responsibilities without seeking glory or acknowledgement. They just care about the mission. And so we at Democracy Forward and Civil Service Strong stand with our federal workers. We're supporting them in the courts and supporting them every way that we possibly can. But we're doing so with the knowledge that the status quo was not sufficient. And we all need to think about a government that can do better than what we had. And as long as you care about that, you believe that the government needs to operate efficiently and effectively for people, look us up at www.civilservicestrong.org and be part of our movement. Thanks, Anne.
Thanks, Rob. Ryan, the final word to you, linking professional civil service, nonpartisan, with a functioning democracy.
Yeah, thank you again so much, Anne, for having me and Rob on. This has been a really important conversation. I think one of the things we need to think about is just how patriotic civil servants really are. Again, this is action and activity that goes on, as Rob points out, behind the scenes. These folks are not getting into these jobs for the paycheck. They're not looking for a path to glory. They are often working behind the scenes in old office buildings, but also in our own communities. These are nurses, healthcare workers, meat inspectors, IT professionals. These are not, again, these sort of faceless bureaucrats, but the folks who really make everyday life better for Americans, which is incredibly patriotic. And
talk about the weather too. Just
yeah, oh yeah, and whether it's the National Weather Service and meteorologists who go and work for the civil service. There's so many things that I think most Americans don't realize only happens because of civil service employees, and making sure that the civil service has undergone this immense transformation from the 1880s to today, where this used to be a real partisan system, where these were handout jobs and patronage jobs, to a merit-based system. Folks are hired based on their expertise and promoted based on their qualifications. And when we lose these employees, it's a huge loss for all of us. It's an immense brain drain for the federal government that is really, really hard to build back because, as Rob points out, these folks are traumatized, trust is broken. And so I think what we really need to engage with is, sort of restoring faith in what government can do. And unfortunately, perhaps we'll see that because of what government is not doing at the moment.
Yeah.
And so, again, I think, thank you to Rob for your great work. And thank you to Anne for having me on today.
Well, and thank you both for coming. That is our show for today. So once again, thank you to our guests this afternoon, Ryan LaRochelle, whom you just heard from, senior lecturer at the Cohen Institute for Leadership and Public Service at the University of Maine, and Rob Shriver, managing director of the Civil Service Strong and Good Government Initiatives at Democracy Forward. You've been listening to the Democracy Forum, a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM, streaming at WERU.org. If you have a comment about this show, send it to news@WERU.org. Put Democracy Forum in the subject line. The League's website is lwvme.org for more information about this topic or to learn about other shows in our series. You can subscribe to our podcast at lwvme.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next month.